From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1887 when the Rochester Electric Railway Company was formed with the goal of building a streetcar line from the company's power plant in Shalott to Ridge Road. Now, on July 3, 1889, the first cars were tested. That day marked the beginning of the trolley era in Rochester. Double tracks were built, new lines were constructed, routes and streetcars were color-coded, for a short time anyway. The story of the streetcar in Rochester mirrors that of the streetcar around the world. In the early 20th century, they served as, well, the great equalizers, offering affordable transportation to people of all social classes. Electric cars reduced pollution, not to mention the amount of horse manure in the streets. They carried billions of people to work and school, and cities were built around their lines. But when the automobile was invented, became more common, travelers' priorities shifted. And the car became king, not the streetcar, the car that you know more often. It led to decades-long battles between the streetcar and the automobile in many cities, with the automobile usually winning and streetcars meeting some ugly demises. There were some exceptions, of course. European cities held on tightly to their trolleys, as did Toronto, for example. And now in the era of climate change, urbanists are asking if the environmentally friendly streetcar can make a comeback. Are they realistic components of urban revitalization? Could we see streetcars return to Rochester? Now, I was thinking before the program began, if streetcars had never existed, and someone said in the era of climate change, you could invent something that is pretty energy efficient, could carry billions of people to and from work, you could design cities around them, wouldn't they be part of the conversation? Is part of the reason they're less of the conversation because they're sort of in the past? And is that the way to the future? Our guests for the hour are going to help answer those questions. And we're going to discuss a film that helped spark this conversation. It's called The Trolley, and it's a look at the history and future, perhaps, of the streetcar. You can see The Trolley next week at the Little Theater as part of Reconnect Rochester's Rochester Street Film Series. It is a svelte little film, about 45 minutes long. They'll have a great discussion afterwards. We'll tell you about the details coming up. But first, let's welcome our guests. The filmmaker of The Trolley is on the line with us, Stephen Lowe. Thanks for being with us, Stephen. How are you?
Thanks, Evan. That was a great introduction. Absolutely spectacular. I don't know what I can add to that.
Oh, I think you can. I think you can. We've seen the film, so thanks for taking the time to be with us. And here with us in studio, Carlos Mercado is a rail advocate and member of Reconnect Rochester's Advisory Council. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
And you're one of what? You're actually a licensed, or what's it called? You're an official what?
Well, I am a licensed streetcar motorman.
Streetcar motorman.
Yes.
I love that. How many of those are there?
I'd say in this area, there's probably about 20 of us tops.
Well, nice to have you in studio with us, Carlos. And Howard Decker is back with us, who's an author, an architect, an urbanist, and member of Reconnect Rochester's Advisory Council, who emailed us recently and said, we had to bring this film here and we had to talk about it. Where did you see this?
Ottawa.
What happened?
It was fantastic. We saw it. Stephen's film is intended to be shown in an IMAX theater, and seeing it with We saw it in an IMAX theater in Ottawa with all the trolleys all around us, 180 degrees. It was fantastic. And Amy and I looked at one another and said, our neighbors in Rochester really need to see this. This is pretty wonderful.
Howard, we have talked about your love of the streetcar on this program and the desire to maybe see it as part of the conversation. At the Shalott Charette a couple of winters ago, there was this idea that all the way up Lake Avenue, maybe from the heart of the city to Shalott, you could see a streetcar. You could see a new system built here. Do you see anything in the last 18 months that adds any momentum to that at all, if you're being blunt?
Probably not something right away in the last 18 months, other than the conversation about our how much we're screwing up our environment with cars. That conversation seems to have picked up some pace and gotten a little bit more visibility in the community. But I think we need to stop and think clearly about the solution that a trolley car represents, the problems that we face, and just do some simple math. And then we'll see why it's so important for us to see this film.
Stephen, why did you make the film in the first place?
Well, I think we're also working on another physics film called Cool Planet. And I've been listening to physicists and atmospheric scientists talk about the urgency of the global warming, the poisoning of the atmosphere, for many years of discussion. And it is critical at this point. It is the most important thing that we could possibly do. most of the people in the world that are either living in urban areas or they're wanting to. Our urban environments are incredibly inefficient, and we were sprawled all over the place. We have to use the infrastructure we built over a century, and the best way to modernize it and make it energy efficient and to use zero-emission energy, potentially, is with electric rail. There is no other alternative. So I don't think we need to debate it anymore. We need to start doing it, laying rail and moving people around with it 100 times more efficient than the car.
And I think that what Stephen is exactly correct. When you stop and think about issues related to the environment and the global warming, you, for example, stumble across some staggering numbers. Here's one. The United States government spends $500 billion a year picking up after a very highly advanced level of storms, snowstorms, hurricanes, floods, fires. We're spending now about $500 billion a year fixing these things, and they're going to increase in frequency, and so the cost will rise. So the mathematics are pretty simple to figure out. When you think about a streetcar system, you're talking about a system that costs maybe $20 to $30 million a mile to construct. And when you talk about global warming and the problems that we face in our environment, you're talking about hundreds of trillions of dollars of cost that will eventually face us Americans and other nations throughout the world as we try and solve this problem. So it seems like pretty simple mathematics. If you build streetcars, the benefits are gigantic, and the costs are, as we place them against the real costs we face in the future, the costs are almost insignificant.
The film is please go ahead, Stephen. Yes.
Yeah, what you see all over the place is exaggerated costs of the streetcar. Most of those costs are to defend the motor monkey and the highways that they own, and every inch of the road is owned by the motor monkey culture. And the cost of light rail is often just buying new land and doing overpasses and underpasses and grade crossings and all of these things that have nothing to do with light rail. It's all about keeping the status quo. So we own these infrastructure. We own this land. It belongs to the public. You could lay rail all over the place very cheaply. It's complicated by the fact that if you want zero emissions, you have to improve the infrastructure. You have to build, you have to use zero emissions. You can't use coal-fired plants. But on the other hand, if you have to use coal, might as well use the most efficient transportation you can. And that isn't battery cars. It's not Musk's heavy, inefficient cars. It's rail. It's just that simple. It's simple physics.
And as Stephen says, it's not autonomous vehicles either that are going to solve the problem. I mean,
How is a gridlock, autonomous cars in gridlock, in battery cars, how is that efficient? It's a distraction.
That's an interesting idea. Let me ask both of our guests in studio for their thoughts on that, because that is, he invoked Elon Musk and among others who are helping pioneer the idea of autonomous vehicles. And when we talk about the transportation future, autonomous vehicles, ride hailing, and battery-operated cars are a big part of the conversation. Do you agree, Carlos? Is that a distraction?
It is. In the transportation business, we have a rather sardonic term we call gadget bon. And gadget bon are all the things that usually appear on Sunday magazine supplements, like starting with the monorail and or other forms, and self-driving cars, and these things that are going to come along. Most of them try to imitate and replicate a train, steel wheels on steel rails, a technology that's been around for 170 years, and the electric component of it, which has been around for 130 years. But they keep trying to come up with a solution before they've even thought through the problem.
How do you feel about it, Howard?
Well, I feel that the autonomous vehicle question, which is more recently being hailed as some sort of solution to our environmental problems, is in fact just more of the same problem that we already have. Because an autonomous vehicle will allow my neighbors in our region, for example, to still sprawl all over the countryside, to not really have to change how they live or where they live or where they work or where they play or where they learn in any way. And so it's more of a funny kind of, as Carlos says, more of a kind of gadget fetish than it is a real solution to our real problems. If we're going to really solve problems that are related to the environment, we're going to have to change the way that we live. Right now in America, 82% of Americans live in cities. And so you look at a number like that and you say, oh, that's great. 82% of Americans live in metropolitan areas, and that means that we're living more closely together and we should be able to solve all of our problems. Unfortunately, when you really dig down into those statistics, what you learn is that over 90% of the growth in metropolitan areas in the United States over the last 10 or 15 years has been in the suburbs. So what we're doing is we're living more and more in metropolitan areas, but we're sprawling more and more outside the city. A streetcar would allow people to live more closely together, work more closely together, shop and work and live more or less in the same place, and not have to get in their vehicle to go and do the kinds of things that we have to do now to support our daily life.
Okay.
So, yeah, it would make a huge difference, and it's much more logical than thinking about autonomous vehicles.
Carlos, you want to add to that?
Well, one early statistic of a technology that's hardly on stream is that the more we automate automobiles, the less attentive the drivers are becoming. And we're starting to find instances where people are hitting pedestrians and cyclists and things because suddenly they've fallen into the trap of, well, the car's doing it all for me. But after all, it is a computer, and if you have a computer at home, you know occasionally it crashes or something doesn't work the way you want it to.
Now, Carl, the only pushback you're going to get from me here is on this. Human beings are terrible drivers to begin with.
Yes.
So,
yeah, right.
It's true. It's remarkable. The things that we try to do. We've banned texting and driving. That's great. We have not banned eating and driving. We have not banned all of the other things that we try to do. Crossword puzzle and driving, Pokemon
shaving.
Go and driving, shaving and driving, all the things that we do, we're bad drivers. We get into a lot of accidents. We cause a lot of damage. We have it costs a lot of money. It costs a lot of tragedy and trauma. So the notion of autonomous vehicles, I understand what you're saying there, but it's probably better than just letting humans do it because we're terrible at it. Setting that aside, I want to kind of go back to the phone because we're going to get your feedback this hour. And I want to be very direct with listeners. Does this sound like part of the future to you? Does this sound realistic to you? Can you envision this actually happening? Do you want to be part of it? It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. The film is showing at the Little Theater 1 week from tomorrow. That's May 8th, Wednesday, 6:30 p.m. It is a svelte little film. It'll be done by 7:15, and then there will be a panel discussion following the screening, and just enough time for you to have a great experience and then get over to the Little Cafe for dinner. So it's just a great setup for you next Wednesday night if you want to attend. And more information on Reconnect Rochester's website. That's reconnectrochester.org. The filmmaker Stephen Lowe on the phone with us. Stephen, I want to ask you a couple of things that your film asserts here, and let's talk about them. You say, first of all, just some numbers here, and this may blow people away the way it blew me away. By the early 20th century, 1,000 trolley companies sold 14 billion tickets a year in the United States alone. You say it was the first effective way to transport large numbers of people at low cost with no pollution whatsoever. Is that hyperbole, Stephen?
Oh, somewhat. I mean, it's depends on your source of energy. If you have hydro and you have, other forms of electrical energy, potentially you could use wood. The earliest generating plants used wood, and that is really zero carbon emission. It's certainly not, it's not fossil fuels. All of these issues get complicated, but the profound simplicity of this issue is physics. How efficiently can you move people around without burning fossil fuels? And there's no way to compete with iron, for one thing. It, you know, cars run on asphalt. That's kind of dirt crawling, if you will. Water and iron are the most efficient transportation. And water is, of course, very, very slow. And unless you want to have a Venice-type environment, the only logical solution is iron, is rail, and using energy, electricity, as efficiently as possible from the power source. Now, if you can't envision quickly solar and wind and hydro, then use bloody coal as efficiently as possible. And that is, streetcars get around half a horsepower per person requirement, or one horsepower, you know, depending on how many people you have on a streetcar. But compare that to the electric cars and internal combustion, and it's hundreds of times less. Well, it's time to stop slugging vodka and start sipping tea. And it's all about physics. I mean, it doesn't really matter what we want anymore. You can keep asking, do you want the streetcar? It doesn't matter anymore. It's what we can afford that matters, not what we want.
Okay, Howard?
I think to come back to the statistic that you mentioned, there were 1,000 companies carrying lots and lots of people in America once upon a time on streetcars. And so we think, well, that's a long, dim, distant, significant but distant fact from the past. But that's not true. If you look at the top 10 metro systems in the world, only one of which is in the United States, they're carrying every year something like 25 billion people. And yeah. So we don't have the mindset in the United States that transit and shared metro systems, for example, can really serve us well. But many other cities in the world, from Tokyo, which is the busiest system there, the Tokyo metro system carries almost 10 million people a day. And so there are a lot of other places that have figured out that transit like this can really solve lots of very significant problems.
I have to get to phones in a second. You've lit up the phone line. Stephen Lowe's film and this discussion has lit it up. But before we turn, one more point here, because Stephen in the film, the narrator says, it's hard to imagine what caused people to turn against the invention that saved their cities and enriched their lives. I want to offer my idea for what caused them to, quote unquote, turn against it. First of all, when you go back to the 1880s, as you say, with the history, streetcars were horse-powered and really only the rich were able to use them. What caused people to turn against streetcars, the egalitarian flavor, was the automobile, because once again, the rich could do it. When people are wealthy and they can sort of get away from the proletariat as best they can, you know, we're a little insular. People like to flex their dollars a little bit here. And my guess, Stephen, is that in this country, your biggest obstacle is that in the United States, the idea of public transportation is class associated. Not so all over the rest of the world, but pretty heavily so here. That would have to change before we saw a public embrace of this, I think. What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not a gizmo issue. It's a question of changing the culture. It's about sharing and selfish. Does every little monkey need a 2,000-3,000-pound vehicle? If so, we're dead. We're doomed. We're destroying the future of the world. It's really that simple. It's time to stop. It's time to start taking the gloves off. And to some extent, it is going to be a cultural or a class thing, because a lot of people just can't afford cars anymore. It was a good idea when combustion was unlimited. We had oil pumping itself out of the ground when we didn't understand damage to the atmosphere. It was fine. You know, sure, give everybody a 4,000-pound car SUV with four-wheel drive. It's nonsense now. A lot of people, a lot of young people, can't even begin to afford the car with all of this insurance and the car, you know, the 40,000 killed on the highways every year. That's a very expensive, reckless transportation system that people can't afford. It is a class struggle now.
We're going to get to that in a second with our phone callers. I will say, this is the first Canadian I've ever heard say it's time to take the gloves off. You know, we're going against type here. We're going against type.
Canadians take our gloves off every night on the NHL.
It's such a good point. I am checkmated on that one. Chris on Twitter, Howard, says, if the public really wanted this, wouldn't we ride the bus more often?
Yeah, of course we would. But right now, the economics are such that we don't have to. We've found a way to live in a city that was originally constructed because of streetcars, to live in a city and in a region originally constructed by streetcars. Now, using cars because the economy of using our cars has overwhelmed the economy of public transportation. So, absolutely. I mean, it's cheap to use your car. It's easy. It's efficient. You have a loan for your automobile. You've got gas, which is cheap at $3 a gallon. Maintenance of the car is fairly inexpensive. So, yeah, when you look at it in the terms of those kinds of immediate data, it seems like it's obvious that people aren't going to get on the bus. However, ideas have consequences, and our actions have consequences. We've learned. And one of the consequences is that we live in a region where we can't afford to maintain what we've built. The best example of that, of course, is the Inner Loop, which we have filled in because it costs more to...
Part of it.
Yeah, but it costs more to take care of that thing than it takes to take it out. So we're starting to realize that the decisions we've made about cars and roads and highways and clover leaves and spreading the shopping out and shopping malls and all that kind of sprawl stuff, we're starting to realize that that equation is not affordable any longer, either in terms of dollars and cents or in terms of the damage it's doing to the environment. So Stephen is right to say to us, it's time, folks, to just really pay attention to what the real equation is here and make changes to the way in which we live.
Okay, Carlos?
Well, we're really blind to the cost, too. I'm an old banker. I'm a recovering banker. And so I'm an inveterate budgeter and look at things. And if most people sat down and they looked at their car payment, how much money they spend on gasoline, maintenance, insurance, and so forth, they would see what a huge portion of their budget it is. It used to be your biggest share was housing, but transportation, because we're at a point now where it's almost every adult member of a household has to have a car because they simply cannot walk somewhere, especially in our weather, to get a bus. And if we turn the clock back 90 years, it's April 30th, 1929, we lived in a compact city that had 400 streetcars running over 200 miles of track. And we have about 200 buses running over several times that amount of highway. So cities were designed from the 19th century onward, only from that point, really, but first for walking, but then to extend your walking range by taking a public conveyance.
Well, you're right, though. These days, it would be a big cultural shift and the way we organize our society shift. I mean, it's illegal to walk anywhere in Henrietta, I think. And the game Frogger was invented based on watching people try to cross Ridge Road. I mean, there's a lot that would have to change.
Amen to that.
But maybe we can. Maybe it's possible. And you have lit the phone lines. Mm. So this is our only break of the hour. And if you're on the phones, we're coming to you next here. We're talking about the film The Trolley, which is coming to the Little Theater a week from tomorrow. That's Wednesday, May 8th, 6:30 p.m. at the Little. And the filmmaker is on the line with us, Stephen Lowe, a Canadian who's willing to take the gloves off. He's the filmmaker behind The Trolley. Carlos Mercado, Howard Decker are here from Reconnect Rochester. Your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, have you considered installing solar on your property? Maybe your workplace has thought about solar, but some big changes are coming for who gets tax advantages for solar. We'll tell you about those changes. We'll answer questions you may have about installation, costs, payback, and more. And we'll talk about some towns that are thinking about some big solar projects that could be coming soon. That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Hey, Jason in Rochester, call us back here. He's a millennial worried that he wouldn't be able to afford an autonomous vehicle. There is something really interesting to see how Gen Z and millennials, generally speaking, you know, adults under the age of 35, 30 years old, are really thinking about transportation future and if there's a generational split. So, Jason, give us a buzz back here. We got more calls to take. This is Tim in Rochester. First up, go ahead, Tim.
Hi, I'm a first-time caller but long-time listener. I just wanted to say I heard a question on there about why public rail disappeared from Rochester. And from what I understand, with past history is that we did have a subway system for a while, but I believe that it disappeared because it was there was basically a conspiracy between the bus manufacturers and some city politicians, which eventually forced out public rail and, you know, brought in our current bus system. I think some of those people actually went to jail over it, but the bus system remained to stay as we see it now. As for bringing it back, yeah, I think that'd be really cool. Rail is one of the most efficient ways to get things around. Even diesel freight, you can move a ton of cargo on 1 gallon of diesel fuel 100 miles. Sure, it gets even better when you put electricity to it. But I think it's going to be really hard to bring public rail back to the city, especially with the way things are built up. You'd be probably seeing a lot of eminent domain being thrown around, and it can be pretty expensive, I'd imagine. But,
all right, Tim.
Yeah,
hey,
for that.
We love first time, long time. Thank you very much, Tim. Howard, you want to take that? Go ahead.
Well, the conspiracy theory about how trolleys were removed because of an alliance between automobile manufacturers and the oil industry is probably not exactly true. Rochester removed its streetcar system in 1941. It was one of the first cities in the United States to take streetcars off the street. And why did they do that? Well, because the low nickel or dime fare wasn't covering enough of the cost of operating it to be able to keep it in operation, A. And B, even by the 20s and 30s, the automobile was already having such an impact on cities across America that people were abandoning public transit and getting into their cars. In Rochester, in 1928, the city mothers and fathers hired a consultant to help them solve the extraordinary problem they were having with traffic. There were traffic jams in 1928 in Rochester, New York. You can imagine what they must have been like. But in any event, this has been this business of abandoning us. Then we abandoned, of course, the subway system we had in 1956, and so we kind of jettisoned all of the transit that originally had created the city, and it happened in city after city in the United States, and it all was because people felt more comfortable and freer and more independent by being in their cars.
Okay, well, thank you for the phone call, Tim. I appreciate that. And listeners, 844-295-TALK, if you want to jump into the conversation as we discuss the trolley. Let's keep the conversation going with Andrew in Irondequoit next. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, you guys. Great show, Evan.
Thanks.
Hey, look, Tim, I love you, man. And Steve, I love you, too. I love the steel rail, the efficiency of it. It's amazing. You should definitely take advantage of this. And the reason I like Tim's call is because he mentioned diesel. It takes so little diesel on those steel rails that are highly efficient. You could have tracks up and down Lake Avenue and St. Paul. And they used to have a trolley on St. Paul. But here's my problem. You guys make things so expensive. Rochester built million-dollar bus stops in the 1980s on Main Street. That is insane. You've got to reform government and say, no, you can't just spend wildly. $30 million a mile is just stupid. You want to take the gloves off, Steve? It's stupid to build million-dollar bus stops and say we can build something for $30 million per mile. You could do it very cheap, but you got to reform government, and that's what I got to say.
All right, Andrew, thank you.
Totally,
go ahead, Stephen.
Agree with that. That is absolutely true. I mean, the light rail all over the place is done at such extravagance when you could have a simple wood platforms like they used to. No, we got to build a giant cathedral to government spending. I mean, it's all over. Ottawa did that. They built incredibly expensive stations. You don't need them. You know, we proved that in the 19th century, that you could just pull up to a stop and get on. You know, just a slight raise in the platform. Oh, I couldn't agree more. It's everything government does is excessive, and then they say, you know, it's too expensive. Well, it's too expensive if you do it, but if you do it sensibly, it's very affordable.
Okay, Howard?
I think also that the cost of building a system like that needs to be balanced against what most cities are experiencing as the return on that investment. So you invest X number of dollars to build a streetcar system. Most of the cities in America that have recently built and are now running and operating streetcar systems are seeing a return on their investment of about 10 or 15 to 1. So, for example, in Portland, their system costs $100 million, and they're receiving a benefit, an economic development benefit that's about pegged at about $3.5 billion. More recently,
do you believe those numbers?
Yeah, because I would doubt them, except that I found, when I looked, I found Kansas City, El Paso, Oklahoma City, Portland, city after city, and these are recent streetcar construction projects, city of Cincinnati, Cleveland. They're tracking the value that the streetcar represents to the development of their community, and the numbers are staggering. So it's the classic case of staring a number in the face, a number that seems scary, and not really putting it into the right kind of context to say, wait a minute, we get a huge return on investment because of the economic development that'll take place in our city. It'll have a huge impact on our environmental problems. Let's do the math in a little bit more realistic fashion. And then the cost of light rail or the cost of streetcar is actually not so significant.
Okay, Carlos?
All transportation is very, very expensive, and part of it is government inefficiency, and part of it is simply the cost of infrastructure. And a cost of two tracks in a street is very similar to maybe about five or six lanes of highway, with a carrying capacity four or five times greater because of the aforementioned efficiencies of rail. But it's also where a community decides they want to put their money. And in the past couple of years, we opened a beautiful brand new train station. And for about double that cost, we also did some very fine upgrades, largely cosmetic, to the Rochester Airport. And people would probably, if they're even aware of what happened to the downtown train station, they're much more enthusiastic about the airport because the so-called right people are more likely to go in and out of the airport than the train station.
And one more thing, one more point, Evan, and then we'll move on. But Rochesterians should actually take a look and try and understand how much money we spend every year on fixing or repairing or extending our highways. Most years it's somewhere north of $200 million. It's easy to see, for example, Kendrick Road or the 390, 490 interchange. These are all of these are well over $100 million projects. So when you put the cost of public transportation up against the money we're spending, as Carlos rightfully points out, to build roads, to maintain roads, to widen roads, to extend roads, it doesn't even make sense. So we have to learn how to do our arithmetic in a different way. The way it's normally phrased doesn't make any sense.
And Stephen, just to kind of put a finer point on something you raised earlier, I understand the desire to look at any potential project and say, is this cost efficient? What is going to be the government cost? Is there waste involved? Is there a better way to do it? I also heard you say, though, we have to do this. You know, we have to sort of grapple with the fact that the way we've set up our societies doesn't work anymore for sustainability. Is that fair?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have no choice at this stage, especially consider the sprawl we've built, unless we just want to burn it down and start with a dense city. No, we have to have electric rail. Here's a bit of a creepy thing about economics, though. We talked about airports. The dumber the transportation system, the more taxes it generates. So this profound waste, which is aviation, generates huge taxes for the government, and including wasteful cars. I mean, the Americans had fuel efficiency standards developed, I think, by Jimmy Carter, and then for cars, and then looked the other way for trucks and SUVs. The reason for that is really simple. The government makes a fortune off inefficiency. They live off it like heroin, off inefficiency. So the bigger the truck and the SUV, and the more sprawl you create, the more money goes to the government. It's insane, basically.
Stephen, can I ask you to address an email before we get back to your phone calls? And my goodness, if the phone calls are any indication, you're going to need two theaters at the Little Theater next Wednesday night at 6:30 mm-hmm. for the showing of The Trolley, the film that we're talking about this hour. Tim in Pittsford says, I'm a big fan of rail. My wife and I lived in the city for a bunch of years and loved it, and the idea of rail throughout the city would be great. We decided to move out to the country, and now we love it here. We didn't move to where we are now because we wanted neighbors. Honestly, we moved out here to enjoy the country, to be left alone, and to provide our kids some land and woods to play on and explore. If you want to send rail out here, great. If you want to charge me an extra $100 a year in taxes for it, I'm fine with that too. But not everyone wants to live in the city. The idea of being left alone appeals to us. Call us selfish, but again, if you want to tax us a little more to be left alone, that's okay. Believe me, we're used to high taxes in this state, and my wife and I will be happy to take our gloves off anytime to protect our land. Tim in Pittsford, what do you say to that, Stephen?
Oh, I think that's fine. The more efficient a system is, the more it can sprawl, the more it can move out to the edges. If you're using 100 times more horsepower, that's more inefficient. There was electric rail all over America. A very, very complex interurban system. Just Google interurban rail in America. It was all over the place. Very thin traffic routes, very, very light, fairly light rail. Fast, efficient interurban system. Again, it's back to physics. If you're confused about economics, think about the physics. The more efficient something is, the more effective it is in all applications, including thin routes out in the country. You can't beat physics, and you have to forget. You have to distract yourselves from the gizmos, which is kind of a phony science, and focus on the physics. You really need maximum efficiency and zero emissions, or no fossil combustion.
All right, so, if you're on the phone, let's get through as much as we can in the remaining time. We've got a lot to work through. Herman in Brighton, let's keep it moving. Go ahead, Herman.
Hello. I love streetcars, but why isn't anybody considering trolley buses? They're used very widely in Europe. In fact, some older streetcar routes have been replaced with trolley buses. They have the advantage that, first of all, you don't have to lay down any rails. You only need the overhead wires. So I would think there's it's cost less, the initial infrastructure investment, and they can change lanes so they can get around, you know, traffic, and they can pull over to the curb. And, I mean, they operate like buses, except they operate on electricity that goes through overhead wires. So why isn't anybody talking about that?
Yeah, thank you, Herman. Go ahead, Stephen, and I know our guests in studio want to hit that too. Go ahead, Stephen.
Physics. We're back to physics. The bus crawls around in the dirt, and the trolley sits on iron. It's profoundly different. It's about 10 times less efficient.
Okay, very direct answer.
And it's not self-guided, so you don't have the benefits of you can't increase the capacity. A train can be an unlimited length, and a trolley bus can only be about 40 people. Well, the new light rail, a lot of these things carry, you know, up to 1,000 people in Europe, light rail. So the trolley bus is poor in a lot of senses. It's better than a diesel bus, I suppose, but you're giving up physics. You know, those big fat tires churn up a lot of energy.
All right, so there is Stephen's response. Howard, you wanted to jump in too. Go ahead.
Well, I think that, first of all, I would say that we would love to have as many different kinds of transportation in Rochester as possible. There are dozens of modes, different kinds of transportation that would allow people to live a much better urban life. And if trolley buses was one of those tools, great.
Yeah.
But I think
sure.
that what we found is that in terms of a bus has a lower first cost, but in terms of life cycle, buses are actually more expensive than streetcars because they are needier in the realm of what Stephen is describing, their physics. So, you know, fine, let's have trolley buses, no problem. Let's just take a look at what it's really going to do to help us, how it's going to help us, and how much it's going to cost.
Okay, Carlos?
They're very heavy and wear out the roads.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Carlos?
That's the other problem. I forgot that. Yeah.
Well, the trolley bus, of course, came in when streetcar companies were abandoning the trolley lines because people had shifted to cars, but they still had a lot of copper wire to depreciate on their books. These were private companies. The government didn't get into they got into the highway business around World War I, but they didn't get into the transit business till well into the 70s. And so I would say there are two applications where trolley buses can work other than depreciating overhead. One is very hilly environments where the cost of a streetcar might not yet be justified, and I'm thinking of Seattle, San Francisco, places like that, because the electric motors, traction motors, are extraordinarily powerful. The other is the gadget bond, and that's what I call it, called BRT, Bus Rapid Transit, which is, you notice BRT, it's sort of a Bronx cheer, but people are, that's one of the things they hang on. Probably if you built a limited right-of-way bus with a trolley overhead, that could justify it a little bit, but it would only be an interim step to rail.
All right, Linda in Penfield next on the phone. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I agree with everything you say, and my question is, how could you persuade or convince people to your point of view without using statistics? Because as we know, there are folks out there who even deny that there is climate change or global warming and who do not respond to statistics. So that's my question, and I await your answer.
Thank you very much for the phone call. I'll start with Stephen. Go ahead.
Well, it's a better lifestyle. I mean, you can see it all over Europe. You want to go to Montpellier or something, the air is cleaner, it's quieter. You have a lot more room for, you know, human life, festivals, festivities. You know, it's just a better lifestyle. And it's cheaper, more affordable, by dramatically more affordable if you amortize it over a period of time. It's a wonderful life to get rid of the cars, and it's not hard to find. You can find it in different parts of the world. So there's no statistics in a better quality of life. It's just needs to be, and I think as people get more and more of it, they learn that it has huge advantages. It creates, I mean, half of America's parking lots. I'm exaggerating.
No, it's 64%
huge.
Now.
61%. 61% of the land inside the Inner Loop in Rochester, New York, 61% of that land is used for parking.
Holy cow.
Okay.
Well, there's your life right there, ruined.
So there you go, guys.
Carlos, how would you answer Linda's question?
Well, when I was a child, I could remember getting up on the 3-meter diving board, and I was terrified, frozen. Then once I did it, I couldn't wait to get back up on it. And yes. I think for a lot of us, the thought of getting on public transportation is as terrifying as the 3-meter diving board when you're 6 years old. But once you do it, and again, it's predicated on there has to be something reasonably close to your house. Once you get on a bus and did it, and I commuted for many years doing that, you develop a kind of community, you get a pattern, and the biggest thing is your brakes and your tires and your gasoline tanks seem to last forever because the car is sitting in the driveway. So a lot of times it's just breaking a cycle and doing something which today seems unthinkable.
Okay, Howard.
One more thing.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Stephen.
I'm going to shoot this in. It's something that nobody wants to talk about. But the biggest health problem in our lifestyle, American, Canadian, Western lifestyle, the biggest single thing is obesity. And it is a hideous problem. Even children now are facing that all over the place. It's in my lifetime, it's grown enormously. Now, there are a lot of factors, but the main factor is lack of mobility. Public transit forces upon you a better lifestyle. You do have to walk and move around. I learned this from traveling, and I spent a lot of my time in Japan when I was young, and the crews would lose like 10 pounds just being in, and it's not just the diet. It's public transit. You really are a healthier person when you get rid of your car.
Okay, Howard Decker.
I would say my answer to Linda's query about wanting to convince people about streetcars without using statistics, the best answer is come see the film. One of the reasons why I think Steven's film is so wonderful is because it makes a very compelling case for the value, the real experiential value of streetcars, without talking about numbers and statistics, the kinds of stuff that Carlos and I as transit geeks do all of the time. We could go on and on with numbers forever, but the film is really compelling. It's very powerful. Steven did a great job in crafting this as a piece of advocacy in favor of what streetcars can do for our cities. And Linda, come see the film, because that's what's going to convince you.
It's next Wednesday, May 8th, 6:30 p.m. at the Little Theater. The film is called The Trolley. It's only about 45 minutes long, and then a panel discussion will follow the screening at 6:30 p.m. More information at reconnectrochester.org. Let's squeeze in as much as we can here. Edward sends this, and this is a local question. I'll kick this over to the Reconnect folks. This conversation about national and global trolley use has my head spinning. Could you bring the topic closer to home? I'm a retired curmudgeon who hates to drive. I enjoy attending movies at the Dryden Theater. I live near the Fairport Road Wegmans, 6.6 miles from the Dryden by way of East Avenue. I would greatly prefer to use public transportation to get to the Dryden and Little Theaters, but the bus runs too infrequently and the route is extremely indirect. I would love to have a trolley running the entire length of East Avenue all the way out to the Canal Park in Fairport Village.
It used to. And I think Carlos really kind of offered some numbers earlier that were very important. The number of streetcars that were here once.
400.
And the number of miles of track that were here once.
200.
And how often the trains ran. They usually ran about 5 to 10 minutes apart.
24 hours a day on major lines.
So you could actually get somewhere using transit without having to wait an hour and a half for a bus or... I'm being uncharitable, without waiting an hour for a bus. And now we have what we call headways, the time between one bus and the next, which are very, very long. And we really can't use transit to get anywhere unless we plan a week or 2 weeks in advance. So I think the answer is we had it once. It's what made our city. And what we need to do is find our way back to that.
Carlos, real quick.
During the discussion next Wednesday, this is another reason you have to come, we are actually going to show some maps that have been designed by City Studies showing where people live, work, and do their things. We refer to them as heat maps. And they do show that there is sufficient density in certain parts of Rochester to run trolleys from about Ridge Road on Lake Avenue to Monroe Avenue to Highland, Main Street from Bull's Head to Winton, and also connecting our two hospitals, RGH down Portland through Main, Alt Genesee Street to the U of R, and a medical center. They exist. The bus statistics prove this and the history. So it's probably, again, the change in attitude.
Well, Dennis says, relative to the ongoing discussion, I believe the rail line out of downtown to Shalott still exists. Why not propose using that? Looking at Google Maps, rail routes remain. Start by using them to get this going.
Now, he's got to come to the film, too, because the Reconnect Rochester transit guys, all of us transit geeks, have started to think about where things should go and what could happen based on existing uses of land. And he's right. We can run a streetcar on rights of way that already exist without screwing stuff up. And maybe on Wednesday night next week, we'll have a chance to show how that could work.
Okay, down to our last minute or so here. Stephen Lowe, I'm going to give you the floor, and I will tell you that we couldn't even get all of the phone calls and all of the emails and all of the feedback. What has the feedback to your film been like? And do you find yourself making a film called The Trolley in a world in which people go, well, that's quaint? Or do you think there's any momentum for a world to bring back the streetcar in significant numbers?
Well, I think the momentum is going to build whether we like it or not. I think that sadly the film is not being taken by a lot of IMAX theaters because of the resistance of the imagined resistance of car companies. All of the advertising, a lot of the money spent is in brainwashing people by car companies. It's insidious, and a lot of these public institutions are supported by car companies. You know, they build their new museums and institutions with IMAX theaters out in the middle of nowhere so they can charge people for parking. I mean, that's how insidious it is.
Well, Stephen, I want to thank you for taking the time for the program.
That was a bit negative. I would like to say just one thing, that the trolley is the journey of a lifetime. You're stuck in traffic in a terrible daily journey, and it can be a lot better than that.
Well, maybe the past is our future in this regard. Stephen Lowe, the filmmaker of The Trolley, thank you, sir. Thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
You can see his film, Reconnect Rochester, bringing that to the Little Theater, Wednesday, May 8th. That's a week from tomorrow, 6:30 p.m. for that svelte film and the panel discussion that's afterwards. Howard Decker, Carlos Mercado, thanks to both of you for coming in and sharing your insight here.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having us.
All right, short break. More Connections coming up.